Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Edward Snowden talks to NBC's Brian Williams. John Curry says a patriot would man up and come home, while some at the NSA say amnesty should be considered. Should it be? Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan on the incessant broadcast of the California mass killer's YouTube video and manifesto, and whether handshakes with your doctor spell disaster. Then how would you like to never have to eat another meal? You could by drinking a pancake-like mix with all the nutrients a human needs. We'll ask if you're ready for the end of food.
We continue our interviews with gubernatorial candidates. Dr. Joe Avalone comes to Studio 3. And The Globe's Alex Beam tells us about online missionaries converting one click at a time. And wine expert Jonathan Alsop on the effects of climate change on wine. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So before we get to the business at hand, something we wanted to share with you if you haven't read it on online this morning. At our news meeting in the newsroom this morning at 9:15, our colleague Emily Rooney made an announcement. Emily, who I think is an icon, I think it's a fair statement, is it not?
Great newswoman.
Emily announced to the surprise of virtually all of us that at the end of the year, she will be stepping down as host of Greater Boston. She will continue Friday nights doing Beat the Press. You're a frequent guest. And there's a little bit more positive news in there, too.
Well, I just don't want to panic anybody. Mm-hmm. Emily is going to continue to do a lot of work here at WGBH, including going to be with us every Friday to do her now world-famous Emily's List of Gripes and Complaints. I couldn't live without that.
Let me just say, and I don't even know if it's necessary, but it is for me, and I know it is for Marjorie. Emily is one of the most talented, incredible human beings I've ever come across. And one of the reasons, as we said in the meeting, and I know I speak for Marjorie here, one of the reasons why we were so excited to come to GBH in February of last year is because Emily Rooney worked here. And we both really look forward to the opportunity to work with her. And we look forward to working with her in her new capacity at WGBH. But it is at least a partial passing of one of the true greats of American
news.
She's
not passing. She wants to spend She wants to spend more time playing tennis, Jim. Okay, she's she doesn't have enough time for the tennis and the paddleball. Wants to have a little bit more time to smell the roses, as they say.
I tell you, she appears incredibly satisfied about this. I am heartbroken.
Well, I've said this to you before. It is really hard to do what she does, and actually, what you do.
Thank you.
To do a television interview, people have no idea. It's really hard. Very few people do it well. You, I must admit, Jim, I teach you all the time, but you do it very, very well, and so does Emily.
Can I tell you, unlike Emily,
what?
They're going to have to take me out with one of those. What are those things called?
Jaws of life.
Jaws of life, exactly. So in any case, Emily will be with us tomorrow. We can talk a little bit about this when she comes in to do her segment, but we love her, and it's a day to congratulate her for her wonderful work. In any case, everyone from John Kerry to John Boehner is calling Edward Snowden a traitor. You know that Snowden, however, sees himself, I guess you'd say, as a patriot who has served the country by leaking thousands and thousands of documents which reveal the extensive, unconstitutional reach of the NSA's surveillance programs. And last night's interview was broadcast last night with NBC's Brian Williams. It was taped in Moscow. Snowden said he'd like to come back to the U.S. Quote, "Now, whether amnesty or clemency ever becomes a possibility is not for me to say. That's a debate for the public and the government to decide." So we're taking Snowden up on this, opening up our phone lines for a public debate. Does Edward Snowden deserve amnesty? Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, if you missed last night's interview, it's worth going back and seeing. Here's a little tiny tidbit.
We can't become subject to surveillance. We can't give away our privacy. We can't give away our rights. We have to be an active party. We have to be an active part of our government. And we have to say there are some things worth dying for. And I think the country is one of them.
That is, of course, the voice of Edward Snowden, who's now holed up somewhere, well, in Moscow. And he came to the hotel room, knocked on the door of Brian Williams after these secret arrangements that went on over a period of months. It was his first interview with an American network. Does he deserve amnesty? 877-301-8970. You might think, based upon what John Kerry said yesterday, and Kerry had, Secretary of State, had a really, I think, out-of-character, passionate anti-Snowden kind of comment. You'll hear that in a second. You might think that he's speaking for all the government. If he is not, I want you to listen to this. Is NSA Deputy Director Richard Leggett in December. He was talking, and by the way, he's the guy who was charged at the NSA, Marjorie, for assessing the damage that the leaks from Edward Snowden have caused. Yet you'll hear him with one point of view, and then you'll hear John Kerry yesterday offering advice to Edward Snowden. Here it is.
Yes, it's worth having a conversation about. I would need assurances that the remainder of the data could be secured, and my bar for those assurances would be very high. It would be more than just an assertion on his part.
This is a man who has betrayed his country, who is sitting in Russia, an authoritarian country, where he has taken refuge. He should man up and come back to the United States. If he has a complaint about what's the matter with American surveillance, come back here and stand in our system of justice and make his case.
I should have been clear when Leggett was speaking in December. I didn't make it clear. When he said, yes, it's worth having a conversation about, the topic that's worth having a conversation about, according to him, is amnesty for Edward Snowden.
We've already got our first email on this from Mark, who says, yes, amnesty for a hero. You know, we should point out that Snowden said in this interview last night, and it has apparently been verified, that he did try to go through channels to say that this was going—
Legal channels.
Legal channels, yeah. That's right, before he went public with all this information. He also said that there should be a difference drawn between those who reveal government secrets for money to their own interest, and those who, as he did, revealed those secrets to, he says, better the United States of America and let the public know. He delivered those secrets into the public hands through reporters so they could know what was going on. He also says he would not get a fair trial in the United States and talks about these trials being held in secret, which I don't know if that's correct or not, but he certainly has said he wouldn't get a fair trial.
What, like espionage trials? Is that what you're talking about?
That yes, kind of that the Espionage Act should be reformed, and one of the reforms should be that the trial should be open, as most courtrooms are, well, all courtrooms are, unless you're a juvenile or something like
you
that.
You know, over the last couple of weeks, we had the filmmakers of two spectacular frontline documentaries, both called The United States of Secrets, Part 1 and 2. The first dealt with NSA surveillance. The second dealt with Silicon Valley being complicit, to say the least, at least in my estimation, with the NSA in surveilling us. And we spoke to both directors in studio, and one in studio. It's quite clear, again, whether you consider him a traitor, a whistleblower, think he deserves amnesty or not, there's no question the vast majority of the information we now know about what is being done to us and about us is a function of Edward Snowden. While the president was asked about this months and months ago, immediately after it happened, saying, well, without Snowden, none of that, we wouldn't know anything. And he said, and I think it strains credibility, he said, the president said, well, we were well underway with our analysis. All that Snowden did is speed up our analysis. I, with all due respect to the president, I don't buy that notion. Again, whether you're pro-Snowden or not, there's no question he precipitated a debate in America that probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, I also want to point out that in one of the frontline documentaries, I'm not sure if it was United States of Secrets or the other one that talked more about Google and AT&T. I think it was the first one.
They're both United States, Part 1 and Part 2.
Part 1 and Part 2. That people within the NSA who were very worried about going beyond their constitutional limits did try to go to members of Congress, did try to go within their agency to say that this is too much. They were one of them tried to go to a reporter. Remember what happened to them. You know, as one guy said, he's coming out of the shower and there's the FBI with their guns drawn accusing him of doing something terrible, and they were raked over the coals. So needless to say, blowing the whistle on this kind of thing makes the government very, very nervous. And I think Stone's got a point when he questions what kind of trial he'd be getting in the United States of America, especially when you have John Kerry, and I think it a little over the top, calling him a total, complete traitor and a coward. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think? Is he a traitor? Is he a coward? Is he somewhere in the middle? He's facing at least three separate charges, each with 10 years prison term. So he could be facing 30 years in jail, plus whatever additional charges they want to add. Eric Holder has said he's willing to talk about some kind of plea deal. So we'll see.
He's a traitor, even if he's technically a traitor, your question, I'd step back from that and say, does he deserve amnesty for this? Should we put an end to this chapter in American history by granting this guy amnesty?
And you could also, would you be more comfortable with some sort of lesser sentence? I mean, I don't think the guy, do you think the guy should go to jail for 30 years?
No, I don't think, well, we'll hear what the listeners think. Dave, you're in Providence. You're first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Edward Snowden, of course. Hey, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
So I'm an information security researcher and analyst who has seen a lot of similar things that Edward Snowden probably has. It's a common ethical quandary to talk about what it is that he's done. But I think he should receive amnesty. He did go through the proper channels, and that was not answered. Were this a corporation, and this were information that were leaked to the public domain or the press, they would go through legal means that were public in order to deal with it. And right now the government is trying to keep it sealed so they can have ultimate control over it. I would like to make one more point,
sure,
which is that the damage that is being noted that was done, things like the economic damage, we lost $6 billion to a contract in, where was it, Belize?
I'm not sure.
Brazil, I think it was, mm-hmm, actually. We lost a contract for Boeing to a different airline producer, and that contract was $6 billion. We lost it due to the NSA revelations. But the damage that was occurring, that is occurring, that they're noting, is due to the activity that they were doing. It wasn't necessarily Snowden creating this whole big thing that was a spying ring and spying on everybody.
Well, yeah, but Dave, if I can interrupt you, if playing the part of John Kerry for a second, I'm assuming Kerry would say, forget $6 billion. Lives were put at risk, he would argue. And not only lives, relationships that matter were put at risk, I assume he'd say. I mean, for example, the embarrassing and I think scandalous disclosure that we're monitoring the phone conversations, forget of Americans, of Angela Merkel, one of our chief allies, the head of Germany. I mean, there are clearly some downsides. I think those who support amnesty shouldn't, and I'm sure this legit guy from the NSA is not suggesting there wasn't damage, but there's a larger question, and I think you're addressing it. Dave, thanks for the call.
Well, this is a good week to be discussing it after
Why?
The White House just revealed the name of the guy that's running the whole CIA
operation
in Afghanistan.
But that was unintentional.
It was unintentional, but I mean, talk about blowing someone's cover right out of the water. I mean, my goodness. Let's go to David in East Boston. Hi, David.
Hello, David.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
I honestly don't really see Edward Snowden as a hero. I mean, anytime you join one of the alphabet organizations of this country, you know what you're getting into. You're going to be doing things that aren't exactly on the up and up. And that's with every powerful nation that's ever been in existence. Also, I mean, he put this information out there. No normal person that lives in this country doesn't think that their government isn't watching us.
Yeah, but David, can I tell you, everything you said is true, but if you watch these two frontline documentaries and you tell me afterwards that you had any inkling how widespread and how deep this surveillance is, I'd have to call you on it. I mean, of course we all understand that things are going on that aren't pretty. But the whole notion, and by the way, lying by leaders of this country about what was being done and what wasn't being done, the guy in front of Congress lying outright, Clapper, lying outright to Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, about what was being done, and then some tortured effort. It's one thing to do what you do, as troubling as it is to me. It's another thing to lie to the American public about it, which they did, and Snowden's light allowed us to find out the truth, I guess. David, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970 is the number.
We have some emails on this. Alan says the Justice Department can't set a precedent by giving amnesty to a person who took an oath and leaked confidential information to the world, including people that want to destroy the country. I don't think Snowden wants to destroy the country, but
Well, then they should never enter in a plea bargain. A plea bargain on anything when you're charged with X and you allow them to plead to Y, and occasionally Y includes no jail time, then they shouldn't do that either, because doesn't that send a bad message too?
Yeah, I'm just reading the guy's email. And Bobby says it's wrong to call whistleblowers such as Edward Snowden criminals or traitors when they release proof of crimes committed by or in the name of our country. I guess Peter King was on Morning Joe Christopher's email to say that Republican congressman from New York, saying some of the information that he leaked helped Al-Qaeda.
877-301-8970. Jeff, you're in Uxbridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
part of what I, the reason I called, you've already mentioned, but I don't know how, I was fairly ambiguous about, you know, what I thought of Edward Snowden before I saw the Frontline episodes. The thing that's striking to me is that we wouldn't be talking about any of this if it weren't for what Snowden did.
Right.
And the idea, I was listening to Kerry the other day, the idea that there was some sort of channel that he could go through. I mean, we saw what happened to the NSA officials that worked.
Exactly.
Those that worked for the NSA that tried to do the right thing, that tried to go up the chain of command, they were you know, one was practically going to spend the rest of his life in prison over this stuff. All those charges were completely dropped after the Snowden release of the information. So I think that, you know, I don't know. I'm not ready to call him a hero, but, I mean, it seems ridiculous to me that the government, we know from the, you know, the documents that was doing something that was A, illegal, you know, B, unconstitutional, and he brought that to light in the only way that I think he could have.
And so, by the way, I want to add one thing. I'm so glad you focused on that, because the thing that I know, I speak for Marjorie here too, the most powerful parts of the documentaries was not just the disclosure of what is being, what information is being gathered and how, but how the lives of the most patriotic people, many of whom had spent their lives in mid-level positions at the NSA, were destroyed. And as you say, this one guy lost his wife,
lost every
dollar he had. And
he's
by the way,
at the Genius Bar, at the Apple Store.
And for those who think, well, you know, Obama supporters who love to blame Bush, Bush started some of these prosecutions, and as they go out of their way to say, the prosecutions were continued in the early phase of the Obama administration. So it's a bipartisan outcome. Jeff, thank you for the call.
And, you know, it's also worth pointing out that Edward Snowden tried to join the United States Army Special Forces. He washed out, as he put it himself. But his grandfather was in the Pentagon working for the FBI when the day of 9/11.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. So this is not some lefty from Jim's hometown of Cambridge there that's trying to bring down the government or anything.
Here is a little bit more from last night's interview, if you missed it. This is Edward Snowden on his patriotism. And what he says is the importance of keeping the U.S. from becoming a security state. Here it is. Or it isn't. In any case,
the reality is I never intended to end up in Russia. I had a flight booked to Cuba, onwards to Latin America, and I was stopped because the United States government decided to revoke my passport and trap me in Moscow airport. So when people ask, why are you in Russia? I say, please, ask the State Department.
And by the way, he went on to say, Snowden, I called for the wrong sound, my apologies. Snowden went on to say he has no relationship with the Russian government. That was a question asked by Brian Williams on NBC. Here's what Charles tweets in us. Here's what we know. Snowden didn't lie to us, and everything he has said has been corroborated by countless documents. The other side has not been truthful still to this day. Let's take a call.
Let's go to Robert in Fall River. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Robert.
Hey, guys. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to say that personally, as a honorable discharge veteran, a combat veteran, I think that he did something that was extremely difficult and extremely brave, and he probably labored over this for a really long time. It's obviously put a lot of effort and work into it, so it's not something that he went into lightly. Aside from personally, I will tell you this. One of the last things that I did when I was exiting the military was I was on a ship in the Navy, and you have a meeting with the captain.
We're losing you, Robert. If you could speak directly into the phone, I'm sorry, but we're losing your voice.
No, it's okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, perfectly, yes, much better.
Okay. So one of the last things you do before you leave the ship is you have a meeting with the captain, and it's your opportunity to tell the captain what you liked, what you disliked, what you would have changed, anything. And it's supposed to be no holds barred, as long as it's professional and not profane, you're supposed to be able to say whatever you want. So that being said, there had been a lot that had been going on with my direct chain of command, not related to the captain necessarily or anyone high up, but the direct chain of command were violating a lot of our rights, not in a serious manner, but in a personal way that was affecting every single person that I worked with, personal life. And I brought this up to the captain. The captain immediately said, I was not aware of this. Let me take care of this. The same day we had orders, before they let us go, and they explained, begrudgingly that they would be taking a look at the methods that they had been using and that they would be altering them. And I was immediately punished for my comments, which were deemed valid, especially by the captain, because action was taken on it immediately.
God.
And the only way that I was able to get any reprieve from this was by going to the chaplain, because I was being railroaded, essentially. Mm. I was essentially facing disciplinary charges for doing something that was completely within my rights, which the command had been violating us.
So your point is that you were retaliated against for doing something that you thought was a legitimate opportunity to give a complaint, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
And the government just looked. The government essentially is a big boys' club, and nobody likes to say, "Hey, guess what? You did something wrong, and that you need to correct the discrepancies."
No.
And I feel like our government is essentially very, very proud, to the point of it interfering with our ability to treat our citizens as citizens.
Robert, that thank was a great you for call. A fine call. Steve, we're going to
squeeze
you in.
One more real quick because we're almost out of time.
Hi Steve. Steven. Cape Cod.
Hey, real quick, when our Secretary of State was a war protester, there were those in government that called him a traitor as well.
Great.
I find that to be, it's kind of like, it almost equivocates to what Delahunt is doing down here on the Cape in terms of the hypocrisy of it all. After watching Snowden last night, and I came into it, I watched the whole interview without any opinion as to his guilt, his innocence. He tried to inform the people in power about what was going on, and those in power that think that they have the right to to make judgments beyond the limits of their purview without consulting with the constitutional rights, whether or not they're being violated, I just need to be held to account.
Steve, we got it. We got to go. Steve, thank you. And it's an interesting reference to John Kerry decades ago. It was a young Vietnam vet.
The email was divided. Lots of people thought that he should get no amnesty and he is a traitor. But anyway, to be continued, because up next, we're going to talk to medical ethicist Art Kaplan. He's going to weigh in on school lunches and schooling Republicans on nutrition. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
How the Snowden deal went down, along with the U.S. Constitution.
The documents reveal an NSA that say radically different things in private, that there should be no place where you can go and communicate free of the NSA's intrusive eye.
Glenn Greenwald on the public trust, why Edward Snowden came to him, and why we can never go back to our old assumptions about privacy. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for our programs comes from you and the communities of Orchard Cove and Newbridge on the Charles, offering you the information you and your parents need to make the right decision about senior living. You can check out the guide at hslindependentliving.org. And Grogan & Company Fine Art Auctioneers, announcing their upcoming June 8th auction, including over 700 lots of fine art, jewelry, silver, furniture, decorative works of art, and rugs. You can view the online catalog at groganco.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So how do you feel about doing the bump with your doctor, the fist bump, that is? Turns out that's the healthier alternative to the classic handshake. And the First Lady of the United States is getting political, taking on the House of Representatives for threatening to bag healthy school lunches. Here with us to take on these and other health and medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the book Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hello there, Art.
Hey, folks. How are you?
Excellent.
Hey, great, Art. Great to talk to you as always. So let's start with this case of this Elliot Richard. He's the latest 22-year-old mass murderer to go on a spree out in California. There's been a lot of controversy this week, Art, as you know, about showing his manifesto over and over and over again on television, his picture, talking about him nonstop. You were quoted in a piece about the right way to publish a deranged killer's manifesto. What is the right way, Art?
So I've had to wrestle with this problem a little bit because it comes up in how do we publish or put into journals data that came from immoral experiments. Think Nazi studies that might have generated something of scientific value. And I think this is analogous. You've got a very misogynist, very evil person who's done horrific things. He's got this manifesto. He wants us to think about it, look at it. All right, we want to understand him. We want to see what might have fueled his sick hatred. But I think you put it in. You don't put his name in. You basically put it into context and explain why it is that you're putting this thing forward. You try to, in other words, diminish fame and celebrity to the person. You try and focus in on what could we learn that might give clues to preventing this or understanding the sources of his, you know, troubles. So to me, it's all context, and it's trying to downplay the credit.
And Art, why is I had James Allen Fox on my television show last night from Northeastern. He had written a piece in USA Today, and through the years, he said similar things to you. He's a criminologist, so coming at it from a slightly different perspective.
Yes, we call those correct.
Hey, he said, you know, fine, say the name, don't say it repeatedly. Show the YouTube video, don't show it nonstop, as we're all doing. Limited excerpts from the manifesto. His concern is about potential copycats who are saying, I want to be high profile, I want to be the lead story in the news, and they might do something they would otherwise not do. Is that where you're coming from?
No, I'm not quite as worried about copycats because I think, sadly, the mere terrible drive-by kind of shooting and you know, just the event may trigger that kind of concern. I'm a little bit more worried that we not be voyeuristic, that this not become kind of evil porn, that we kind of take this guy's political or social views or between the genders views more seriously than we ought to. I don't want him to be seen as a scholar. I don't want him to be seen as someone we have to listen to. I want him to be seen as someone we have to try and understand. We have to figure out what went wrong. We have to figure out what is wrong. So I'm a little bit more worried on the manifesto side that we don't somehow just, you know, put it in there next to the op-eds and the editorial page.
But you know something, Art Kaplan, part of me thinks the cat is out of the bag here, that I know a lot of TV commenters have said Art Anderson Cooper at CNN and Megyn Kelly at Fox have, you know, declared they're not going to name the victims, or they're certainly not going to name them very often. But if you're into this kind of sick stuff, you just go online and there he is and there's everything for you to see.
Right. I don't think you can get rid of it. I think the best you can do is minimize it. And also the mainstream media and, if you will, academics and other people who want to comment on these events, mental health people, they can sort of say, well, this is the right way to do it. I know there are people who may wind up just going on the internet and, you know, tweeting the glories of this guy's manifesto. But I think what we should do is discourage it, tamp it down, do the best we can to, if you will, diminish the harm and not glorify this guy. That's what really bothers me. It's the rewarding of his horrific actions and his twisted thinking. You want to read it. You want to understand it. I'm not saying we shouldn't try to get inside his head, but I don't want to make a hero out of him.
You know, Art, on a related note, we were doing our quarterly mandatory after any mass shooting a talker with some of our listeners yesterday about gun control, about the issue that theoretically the right and the left on gun control agree upon, that there's got to be some advance about limiting people with mental illness, that sort of thing. And I learned yesterday, I'm embarrassed I didn't know this, but my guess is most people don't know this. We generally think, well, but there are privacy rights that can't be violated of people who go to treatment, and if they are violated, they won't go to treatment. And then I'm reading that this Leon Rodriguez, the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Civil Rights, says healthcare professionals now can share information with friends and family members if the physician or professional determines that would be in the patient's best interest. And he goes on to say that they've never taken an enforcement action against a healthcare provider who, in the best interest of the patient, disclosed information to a third party. Not only did I not know that, my sense is most healthcare professionals don't know this. Am I wrong about that?
I think he's wrong. I don't.
You think he's
true.
Wrong?
Yeah, I do. I don't think you can just willy-nilly go around disclosing personal health information to third parties. Families of people with mental illness will tell you they get quoted legislation, they get quoted laws all the time about this is the patient's record, I can't talk about this with you. Now, that doesn't mean they can't listen to family concerns, but I think there's work to do to make it easier to have those conversations go back and forth. You know, we do have a, if you will, a kind of ethical standard on the books. If you think someone's in imminent danger of harm, you have a duty to warn. The healthcare professional does, and that's great.
Yeah, wait, imminent danager of harm to him or herself or someone
others.
Else, right?
Right,
yeah, okay.
Right. So there's a disclosure requirement. But generally, we don't have enough conversation between family members, between parents and children when they're in mental health trouble. I think we got to do better in terms of opening that door up a little more, both legislatively in training.
But before we move off this case, in the Elliot Rodger case, the mass shooter in California, he mailed this manifesto to a couple of his therapists. One mm-hmm. of them called his mother right away, and one of them called the cops right away. So I assume because they were concerned about his being a danger to others, they were within their rights to do that.
Right, and I think the cops had visited his house.
Yes,
and
they had.
Him at one
okay.
point.
Yeah,
so he certainly had gotten to the attention of the authorities, which takes us back to, you know, so what ought we to do? I still think background checks, the kind of core basic common sense thing to do when you're buying a gun, we don't have it, we ought to. And you've heard me say before, I think doctors, nurses should be talking about gun safety, guns in the house, trying to detect whether there might be an unstable person there. You know, it's not that the police have their hands full. They're trying to catch real criminals. You tell them that somebody might do something and... You know, I think a lot of them are thinking, well, let me know when something happens, call me. But we could do better just checking the background of people who want to get weapons. We could do better building the mental health system so it'd be easier to access it. And I really think we ought to push it harder as a health issue.
You know, from the file that you just pulled from, you've heard me say it before. You've heard me say before, Art Kaplan, I was a round little boy for much of my childhood.
Mm.
So Michelle Obama has been my champion on this Let's Move thing, trying to get healthy foods into schools. And she did something very unusual for a first lady. Got involved in politics the other day and essentially called out the Republicans in the House of Representatives who want to allow schools to opt out of these dietary standards that she's in part responsible for, that limit sodium, fat, calories, that sort of thing. How important is it that she wins this thing to this battle against childhood obesity?
Well, as a person who at Saxonville Elementary in Framingham grew up on a school lunch that consisted of a peanut butter sandwich, a butter sandwich, and spaghetti.
Sounds good to me, Art.
Yeah, well, it was tasty. Yeah, I would argue that. I would say she's good for her, and I applaud her. And I think it's time. Kids can't really protect themselves from what politicians do. They need an ally. They need an advocate. She's a strong one. This notion that we can dump, which was what they were doing at my school lunch, surplus products, you know, dairy products, excess peanut butter stored, I don't know, from the Second World War or something. That's not the way to run school lunch, and that's not the way to fight the obesity epidemic. Plus, without making a horrible pun, it's penny wise and pound foolish because this obesity epidemic is going to drive us all to the poorhouse. So at least one healthy meal a day, trying to teach good eating habits. I'm with her. Come on, Republicans.
But
let's go here.
But there are. I mean, even Sam Kass, who's quoted in the New York Times, who's the head of Mrs. Obama's Let's Move campaign, said there are quote legitimate challenges. And you know, from the mundane to whole wheat pasta allegedly doesn't hold up for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But there are financial considerations in Boston alone. Much to the surprise of many leaders, these salad bars. How many schools was it, Marjorie? I think six schools throughout the city were dropped the other day, in part because of cost issues.
Exactly.
But I've also read, in addition to cost concerns, that kids, a lot of kids, won't eat this stuff. The conventional wisdom always was.
Because they need time to get
well,
a chance to like it.
Is that the answer to this, that ultimately it's a matter of time? Because they're saying that somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of the kids just won't eat it unless it's a Dorito.
Right. Well, if you're going to, you know, you can't just put them on a diet of kale shakes. I get that. And, you know, the lunch I made fun of that I had as a school lunch did taste good. So I think you can do both. I think you can get cost-effective, reasonably healthy or healthier foods in front of the kids. I understand that, you know, given the choice of, you know, a kind of a cupcake versus carrots, a lot of kids are going to make bad choices. But again, you're not going to get an either-or here. What you're going to do is sort of shape behavior, encourage people to eat healthier when they're young. You set that pattern early. I think it ought to be affordable. I think it ought to, I mean, I think we can make it affordable. Mm-hmm. We don't need the exotic foods. We just need healthier foods. So I'm not buying that completely.
We're talking to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Art, I want to ask you about this lawsuit in New York City where a mother is suing her doctors for malpractice, claiming she went in. Well, she did go in. She didn't claim it. She had two kids already that she delivered by C-section because of complications. She really wanted the third child vaginally, no C-section. And she's suing them, claiming they substituted their judgment for her, and they pressured and threatened and basically bludgeoned her into delivering the baby by cesarean section, saying there's going to be problems with the baby. I don't know what the truth is in this case, but I do know that since the mid-90s, C-section rates have gone up to, like, now they're like 33% of babies are born by C-section, whereas the World Health Organization says it should be 10 to 15%. So something's going on here with these C-sections.
Well, first of all, you should not be bullying anybody into any procedure. Women who don't want a C-section, even if it raises risk to the fetus, it's their call about what people do to them. You can argue with them. You can try to persuade them, but I wouldn't be threatening them, saying, you know, we're going to take your kid away or you're going to lose your rights or whatever. That's not the way to deal with a balky parent. The overall problem isn't forcing C-sections on unwilling moms. It's scheduling C-sections because the mom says, hey, I think next week I'd like to have the baby, and then we'll go on vacation 3 weeks later. C-sections are not the best way for moms to give birth. They're surgery. They're riskier. We've got a culture that sort of said, hey, you know, let's have them on demand. Let's schedule them as opposed to a vaginal delivery. There's even evidence that shows it's better for the baby to get born through the birth canal in terms of the microbes and stuff they get exposed to. So, absolutely overusing the procedure. One other reason, because right behind that surgical suite, somewhere lurking around is a lawyer. And the doctors are thinking, geez, we get in trouble with this kid. We're going to get sued. Let's take the safest course, get the baby out. It may be tougher on the mom, but at least that'll keep the lawyers at bay that we did everything we could. So if you want medicine practiced by malpractice attorneys, that's what we've got in the C-section space.
Hey, Art Kaplan, do you know Howard Minkoff, a doctor, chair of the obstetrics department?
Only by name.
Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn.
He's got a great quote.
Here's a quote in this New York Times story. Women have an absolute right to refuse treatment, even if it means death of an unborn child. He goes on to say, in my worldview, the right to refuse on the part of the woman, obviously, is uncircumscribed. Are you where he is?
I'm ready to argue with the woman. I'm ready to challenge what she's doing, but I'm ready to ultimately say your body, your choice, your call. We don't foist medicine on people, even when a fetus's life hangs in the balance. Now, that doesn't mean we don't go to the mat and try to change that mind, but I just can't imagine doing a major operation on an unwilling patient. And you try to think, well, what's the aftermath going to be? If she really doesn't, for some reason, want this done or doesn't want this fetus, things are not going to go well. So you've got to bring them around to caring about the baby. That's the mission.
So, Art Kaplan, you wrote a great piece about the perils in medical circumstances of the handshake. Please tell our listeners.
Oh, boy, the listeners are they're sticking their hands who knows where. I know the kind of audience that listens to this show.
It's a they're motley crew.
Covered in filth and, Jim's. They're now, dripping ice cream off his hands. It's all bad.
I'm actually eating a carrot as we speak, to tell you the truth.
But he didn't wash his hands. Where's the Carell? So the real issue is in the hospital, tons of infectious agents and doctors, nurses, I wish, but they don't wash their hands. And, you got to yell at them if you're in there and you see somebody that doesn't wash their hands, your doctor, nurse, yell at them. And by the way, visitors. So the family comes in and they see you and they touch you and they touch the bedding and they didn't wash their hands when they came in the room. So we got all these infection-related deaths and all these microbes building resistance. One way to prevent transmission, it's only one way, it's not the solution, is to not shake hands. Better the fist bump. Even better, give a thumbs up to one another. The more you can diminish contact, and I know, you know, we've already got a problem in hospitals with people thinking doctors and nurses aren't friendly enough, but there really are these infection problems, and the old-style handshake, it's pretty good in the street, but it's you're shaking hands in a pool of microbes, so you don't want to really be doing that.
You know, you cite a statistic in this piece that to me is horrifying. Rates, I'm reading from a piece Art wrote, rates for hand washing for doctors, nurses, and volunteers hover around 40%. 6 out of 10 healthcare providers don't wash their hands. Is that possible?
Yep. And there's another study, I don't think I had it in there, that says, and they get mad when patients point it out. So point it out, make them mad. They forget, they're busy, they're running around, that happens. A lot of places have stuck the Purell all over the place, so it's kind of hard to miss it. I was in I had a little minor operation done a couple of months ago, and I had plenty of time to lie there, and I decided I'd wash hand-washing behavior. And what you see is people come in, they wash their hands, they touch everything in the room, and then they don't wash their hands when they go out. So that's also part of this. It's washing them sufficiently. You know, it reminds me, when I washed my hands as a kid, my mom would say, wash your hands. I'd run them under the water, and that would be it. That isn't washing your hands.
You're supposed to keep scrubbing for like 20 seconds, or what I said, well, the alphabet or something.
At least enough to get the Purell over both hands. You know what I mean? If you just bop the button and then a little bit of moisture gets on your hand, you haven't washed your hands. So that's part of what the problem is. It's washing your hands properly. Anyway, forget all this. I'm almost ready to give up on it. Don't shake hands.
Yeah, but by the way, I think you're supposed to wash hands. You're supposed to sing All Along the Watchtower. I think
one time. Like that. Okay, right.
But, you know, you made a very good point in the middle there.
Free bird, if you're really hygienic.
That shouldn't be lost is the relationship with medical professionals, particularly doctors, because I think most people feel really warmly towards nurses. But there is a doctor thing with some people. One of the ways you break that thing down is by touching the person. I mean, handshaking is a really important, you know, bonding kind of thing with human beings. So isn't the way to address this to get these people to wash their hands
I mean, the best thing to do is to do that. The next best thing is to say, not going to shake hands because we got, you know, there's an infection thing and we're trying to tamp that down. So we're going to do a little thumbs up with one another, or we can do I'll pat you on the shoulder, that sort of thing. By the way, just to make Marjorie really disgusted, not only is it hand washing, but think about this. How often are they washing those white coats?
Oh, God. That's another
disgusting
thought.
I knew you'd jump at that.
Yeah, all the germs
on
the
coats. My passions. One of my passions. I get these residents coming in and say, when's the last time you washed that coat? 6 months ago.
I just want to be clear on one thing. Okay,
she can't even speak.
it's kind of disgusting to think about, especially at lunchtime. But I want to know. So you're not shaking hands rather in the medical setting. You're still doing it on the street, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to at social events. Okay, I just want to make sure where I can
handshake
and where I can't.
The problem is there's so many weird bugs
and
odd microbes in the hospital.
Yeah, okay.
That's what you don't want to be sure.
So Howard Hughes knew what he was doing. Hey, one last thing with you, because we're going to talk to our listeners about this in a couple of seconds. Marjorie and I, about a week or two, read a piece in The New Yorker that Chelsea, our colleague, had given to us, essentially about the end of food. And it's a topic that I'm very interested in. For those who don't know about it, it's this product called Soylent. And it's born in the Silicon Valley. And the founder of this company basically says things like, of course we need amino acids and lipids, but we don't need milk in which it comes. We need, the essential minerals and vitamins from fruits and vegetables, but fruits and vegetables are mostly water, so we don't need those. So essentially he's put together this product that's got all the nutrition we need in sort of this shake that's like a pancake batter that allegedly would keep you healthy. And you don't have meals. You don't eat food as such. You eat the nutritious stuff. And some of the arguments have been made that, you know, the end of mealtime is a horrible thing because of the social aspect of it and the break in the action, whatever. But this is also a scary thing to me in terms of slippery slopes and ultimately saying, you know, in some state that's not so, maybe this is ridiculous, that is not so crazy about the food stamp programs. Well, we're going to keep poor people alive, but they don't need to have fruits and vegetables and a hamburger. They can just have some Soylent. Are my fears completely unfounded? I'm assuming they are. Are they?
No. I think your fears are justified, although not tomorrow morning. I mean, how many people out there now, let's all fess up, are taking vitamins and say, well, then I don't have to eat that broccoli?
You told us not to take vitamins 2 months ago, didn't you?
I know, and I don't think you should.
I stopped immediately.
There's a lot of folks out there, you know, saying, oh, this is a substitute for that. I don't really want to eat that stuff. I'll just take these vitamins. I know it goes on out there. People tell me they do that all the time. And it's a version of what you're worrying about, Jim. So are we going to move toward a world of food manufacturing, of pastes and pills? By the way, this is Hollywood's worst nightmare because all that food porn movie stuff they're doing with the chefs glorified, going to be out the window. Who wants to go to a movie where somebody says, yes, I make the pills that you can eat? That keep you.
That's right.
But I think it's coming. I do. And I think, by the way, too, is a fun thing to think about. What if you could reduce foods to a kind of biochemical paste and or grow them from cells, say meat cells? Would vegetarians still be vegetarians if their food didn't come from meat, but was basically meat-like, or was grown only on meat cells, no animals killed in the making of this food? I think that's going to be an ethical debate that's going to be with us. Just like we have natural childbirth and hospital childbirth, we're going to have the real food eaters and the, hey, I'm going to take this by a pill.
Marjorie has a look on her face that is frightening.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to spend my days having pancake batter morning, noon, and night. It's like it reminds you of your elderly relatives that had that Ensure, that drink, right, that you see in the nursing home.
On a theme. It's exactly what it is.
I mean, I'm hoping to hold off on that for as long as I can. You know what I mean, Art?
And it's only because you have a rich, engaging social life. But if you're like an isolated, lonely person like me or Jim, then you just swallow your pancake batter and move on. You know, I mean, there's no one who wants to really sit around the table and kick around the conversation. So you know what I'm getting at. I mean, for some people it's efficient, and for some people it's social.
You're very astute, Art.
You know, I'm going to be in New York in a week or two. I'll call you up, Art, and we'll go out for a Soylent
Shake. Exactly. We'll go for some pancake batter.
Art, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Art Kaplan, who is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, and he also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. And now we're going to open up the lines and ask you, is Soylent your thing? Their logo is Soylent. Free your body. Instead of giving into cravings or hunger pains, instead of having your body shackled to the routine and tedium of grocery shopping.
I love grocery shopping.
You do love grocery shopping.
But go ahead.
But you could get rid of cooking, too, Jim. You could just live off a simple, easy to prepare formula, less than $10 a day on food, and you get to chug the equivalent of pancake batter. Can't get enough of that. Grainy pancake batter. Tastes a little bland. But it's not seen as weird. It's seen as, well, I'm not sure if that's true, but seen as sustainable, a sustainable form of substance. Here's the number. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Would you take the Soylent Challenge? Maybe you're already taking the Soylent Challenge. Or does the idea of doing away with meals and mealtime seem ridiculous, uncivilized, and inhumane?
Can I vote?
Yeah.
Ridiculous, uncivilized, and inhumane. 877-301-8970. I've read a lot about this. I was in Chicago a couple of days ago. I read the long piece in The New Yorker about this. The pluses are this, and I'm not subscribing to them, but one, you don't have to waste any time or virtually any money on meals. You can do this really quickly. You can work till you drop. It'd be far easier, some argue, to feed the world's poor. It's much more portable.
Please.
Well, I'm giving you the arguments. And thirdly, the one thing that drove me nuts, you may like this, some feminists are arguing it ends the sexual division of labor, because who does most of the cooking? Who does most of the cooking?
The wives.
Okay, fine. Now, here are the minuses. One, and this is the biggest to me, food goes from, you know, a requirement of life to essentially a luxury which poor people would not be invited to participate in. It's the end of, I'd argue, entertainment, leisure, socialization. You know what I also realized?
What?
It's the end of Corby Cummer, our buddy from the Atlantic and Boston Magazine. Be no need for him. We got to ask him about it next time we see him. 877-301-8970. But as we explained, Art, the notion is, and again, I don't know the science, I just know what I read, is all the nutrients you need would be in this pancake-like food. formula. So theoretically, you could live, I was going to say, and prosper. I don't know if you could prosper because I don't know if that's really living. But if you don't think this is the wave of the future.
Oh, you're
at
crazy.
Least, it is.
You're
I'm crazy. Telling you right now.
I could see where people would do this in the morning if they're like in a rush or they want or at lunchtime. They might say, okay, like those little, you know, drinks you buy when you're on a diet. You buy those drinks and you drink them on the way to work and maybe you have one at lunch or something like that. But to think you're going to give up chewing, I mean – gosh, Jim, what do you have teeth for? Why don't we just grit up our teeth if all we're going to do is
beautiful.
Have the soylent all day
that
long?
That is a very good
don't
point.
Don't you want to chew from time to time?
So evolution,
have a nice
if we
crunchy
did,
salad in there every once in a while?
If we did soylent, essentially humans, what, in a million years from now, would have no teeth.
No
is
teeth.
That,
that's
that
correct.
Is our Darwinian position.
A lot of money, I suppose. You wouldn't have to worry about those root canals I'll and cavities you. And getting them whitened and all that stuff. 877-301-8970. I think this is utterly ridiculous.
But the concept, again, I don't have a science background, as you know, but when you read the article, the scientific concept makes sense. I don't think it's a desirable thing, but it does make sense. As long as you get what the necessities that are included in food and avoid the food, you could do this.
Scott says, this is the same theory as a smoothie, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Scott says, doesn't the shake or the process of making the shake destroy or break down the cell wall of the plant substance and eliminates the very important roughage from the diet completely? What's the answer to that, please, Jim?
I have no idea. But you know what I do know?
What?
You know, a lot of employers would say that you don't have to go to lunch. You don't have to. I'm serious. You don't have to leave your desk. You can essentially stay glued. They'll provide free Soylent.
Before we take the calls, nobody is saying that this tastes like a vanilla fribble from Friendly's.
No, but they could add some flavoring to it.
It tastes grainy and bland like pancake batter. Now, I like pancake batter, a little spoonful here and there.
Sure.
But I don't want to drink it all day long, especially when it's grainy. Ugh.
And by the way, can we save a little time here? For those of you who are going to call and say, did they name Soylent after Soylent? Well, actually, we have
yes,
a caller
on
this. We'll get to this in a minute. The caller will try to answer the question. Let's start with Chuck. You're on Cape Cod. We're talking about Soylent, meaning the end of food as we know it. Hello there, Chuck.
Hi, great. Thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
Listen to your show most days.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'd love to eat swordfish on the grill. It's important to have that process. Soylent would probably be really good for my latest adventure, which was a week at sea, because it would be nice to have fully, comprehensive mix it up, know you're getting all the stuff you need.
Right.
But what really catalyzed my call was you mentioned that Art Kaplan shared something about vitamins and you stopped taking them when you heard what he had to say. What was that?
Well, there was actually a study that came out, what was it, 4 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, which suggested that vitamins had very little health value for people. So we asked Art Kaplan about them. And at the end of his assessment of the study, we said, so give us the bottom line. Should I stop taking vitamins? And his answer was one word. He said, yes. Don't spend the money. Vitamins are not all they're cracked up to be. So that's the it's a deal, Chuck.
Yeah,
thanks
but I think
for
lots
the call.
Of us like to take them anyway because I feel like we're not getting all those food groups, Jim.
Can I tell
all
you
those
something?
Nutrients we should.
A multivitamin to start the day with a little Soylent for breakfast doesn't get much better, really. And in fact, the vitamin tastes better than the Soylent. You know what I'm going to do? By the way, the only reason I'm sorry we're doing this today is I am going to. You can go online. You can order this stuff.
Oh,
I'm going to order it and try it.
Well, let me know.
And I'm going to have you try it too. Let's go to Ryan in Foxborough. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Ryan.
Jim, Marjorie, how's it going?
Great.
Great.
Good. Love your show. Listen about every day, too.
Thank you.
No problem. So when Soylent first started, after he was done testing on himself, and then he started, I think, like a group funding thing to try to get out to more people. It's really important, I think, to look at his results because he kept a blog every day. He would report, increases in exercise, increases in all the other aspects of his health. And he also pointed out that he didn't actually, it's kind of gross, but he didn't have to go to the bathroom anymore. So that's one upside to it. And also, he would go out to eat probably like once, maybe twice a week still, because, you do need that, you do need the food, but he didn't necessarily need it for the vitamins.
Well, I didn't know about the first part that you mentioned. Even though I do know, I hope I got the word, is it sulfate, Chelsea? I believe that in one of the mixtures they report... Oh, pardon me. In one of the mixtures that the Soylent founder put together, they put in too much sulfur, and you can figure out what the consequence of that was in the mix. Ryan, thank you for a very informed phone call. You know, one of my favorite movies is, I'm going to rename it here, and I mentioned this, I think, a couple of weeks ago, Garen Daly, My Soylent with Andre. Do you remember? My Dinner with Andres. Some of the great movies of all time about
our
meals.
Food movies.
No, it's really true.
Our food movies, absolutely.
By the way, and the joy, I've told you, when I worked in New York City, when I lived in New York City and I worked in New York City, I worked pretty hard in those days. It makes it sound like I don't work hard now. You know what I would do, even if I didn't get work done till 11 o'clock at night, midnight every single night.
Weren't you at the Carnegie Deli?
No, that was a little bit later in my life. I would end by going out to dinner. Oh. I didn't care how late. If it was 1 o'clock in the morning, I went to the Empire Diner. The point is, the joy of eating in a restaurant, eating out to end a difficult day, was so great that, you know, the food was only a part of that thing. And so the whole notion that this could mean the end of food is really frightening.
The other thing, obviously, is how many times we've read the stories about families are supposed to be dining together so they can share the...
No, it's totally true.
During the day, you're going to sit around the table having your Soylent.
Well, it's a huge socialization part of eating food, obviously.
Okay, dying. Linda from Belrica, what do you think about this ridiculous idea?
Hi, Linda.
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. I would say it's another... idea where somebody wants to sell us a product that they tell us if we buy it, we get everything.
Right.
That is essential. Yeah, that is right.
Food, or it doesn't matter whether it's food or you're buying a fast car or whatever, it's a marketing ploy, because one of the things that a lot of research has shown today is that if you take everything you think that's nutritious out of orange juice and you give it to someone, it still doesn't have the same benefit because there are too many unknowns.
Mm.
We can't put it together the way nature put it together.
That's beautifully put. And I thought you were going to take us where I was going to take us. You were going to mention Soylent Green, because
My first question was, did they really name this product
yes.
Soylent?
Tell people about that movie.
Well, you can say it's a film about humans eating processed humans.
It's a film about the future in which particularly the elderly are told there's an end of life here, to which they go off joyfully, and then they are reprocessed into food for the rest of the population.
Yeah. Now that really gives you an extra incentive to buy Soylent, isn't it? Because you can remember that this is about eating repackaged human beings. Yeah. That makes you feel really good, doesn't it?
By the way, Keith Richard attempted doing a variation on that a little ahead of time, but that was a different thing. Hey, Linda, you have to figure that out for yourself. Linda, thank you very much for the call. You know, they really have you-know-whats to name it Soylent in light of the fact that they admit that it is named after Soylent Green, which is not exactly an appetizing kind of prospect.
No, it is not.
Oh, there's Grandpa
for
lunch.
What do you call the diet drink?
What?
Everybody drinks the diet drink.
I don't know what you mean.
They used to be Carnation Slender or something like that.
That used to be a sponsor of our former radio show, Carnation Instant Breakfast.
Okay.
So be kind.
Yeah, that was Instant Breakfast. I think there's some shake or something you can have of Carnation. Let's go to David in Lexington. What do you think, David?
Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I think it's a crazy idea.
Me too.
And I want to take off on what Ryan said about people don't go to the bathroom anymore. It's bound to wreak havoc with our gut microbiota, who are part of our metabolism. So I think it's a giant experiment that's going to go bad. Also, if you're not going to the bathroom, your colon's going to atrophy.
Yeah, can you do me a favor, because I want to use this at a cocktail party. What is the first part you said? That's not part of my lexicon. What's going to happen? What's the first thing you said, David?
Oh, it's going to wreak havoc with our gut microbiota.
There you go.
Gut microbiota.
Look that up, will you please, Jim?
David, thank you for the call. And by the way, let
Keith,
me just
you
say
know what
here.
Keith is calling it?
What?
Goop.
You know, maybe it is, but let me just mark my word, as
Soylent
the saying goes.
Goop.
Mark my word, if you don't think this is the future in some parts of the world, I don't mean to be heavy about this, of course it's going to be. You don't think that's what ultimately happens here? I mean, they're going to say this is the way we can feed parts of the third world
that are
starving.
Well, I mean, if there's a starvation problem...
That's the start.
I don't think we're going to be handing this out to people that when they go to get there at the food pantries.
No food stamps, Soylent stamps. That's what I'm telling you. In the next Congress... You know, is that any more ridiculous than some of the things the men and women in Washington do now?
The whole school lunch problem will
exactly.
take care of it. Get a little Soylent to the kids, a little chocolate flavor in there, a little extra dollop of sugar. They'll be all set.
Janice here in Stoneham. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
I am a personal chef in the area, and I can definitely relate to, you know, I have a friend who tells me that eating is like this annoyance that he has to fit in around all the things he wants to do, which is very strange. And while I get it, I would be so concerned about the culture that you were talking about, that you were touching on, that would disappear. I see it right now. There's so many kids who don't even know what an actual carrot looks like because all they see is carrot sticks, or an actual pineapple because they get the processed cut up junk. And we're already so removed. I can't imagine taking that away and not having the smells and the camaraderie and the connecting about your day.
Well, it's beautifully, but that is what it's about. I mean, the whole eating experience. I mean, eating itself is pretty great, but the eating experience is such a terrific thing that that's where I think they're going to have a really difficult time. Beautifully put, Janice. Thanks for the call. Let's squeeze in one more quick one, Marjorie.
Let's go to Larry in Boylston. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two thoughts came to mind in listening to number one is North America and South America wouldn't have been discovered if people weren't looking for spices to make food taste good.
Excellent.
Great point.
There's something about food that has to do a lot more with personal satisfaction than nutrition. And the second point is, I just got back from 10 days in Italy. Italy would not have been the same with solvent. Or toilet, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That is the best point of the whole discussion, Larry. Thank you.
Well,
that is totally true.
Says, mealtime is a place of communion, conviviality, even sensuality. It is where we learn to be human.
That's great. Who said that?
Whoever wrote this piece.
I love that.
That is
the perfect description. Italy would not be Italy.
I predict not a happy future for Soylent. That would be my prediction.
I've invested my whole 401k in Soylent, okay. So be careful.
All right. Up next, we continue our second round of interviews with the gubernatorial candidates. Democrat Joe Avalones joins us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Because the vast majority of funding for 89.7 is provided by listeners, this program is available for free to you, your family, your friends, and all of your neighbors near and far. Thanks so much.
Summer and sweltering heat are almost here. But before you eat all those popsicles, a warning. The sugar in them may be addictive. I'm Kara Miller. That's on Innovation Hub. Tonight at 9 on WGBH Radio.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And Berklee College of Music, presenting their summer programs. Your child can study with Mark O'Connor and other Grammy-winning artists, offering guitar, songwriting, musical theater, and more. Info at berklee.edu/summer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are continuing our second round of interviews with the gubernatorial candidates leading up to the June nominating convention in Worcester for the Democrats. Here with us in Studio 3 is Democrat Joe Avalone. Joe is a surgeon. Currently, he's Corporate Senior Vice President at Par Excel International. Joe, it's good to see you again.
Thank you, Marjorie and Jim. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming in, too, Joe. So let's start. Assuming that you win, you win the Democratic nomination, you go on to beat whoever the Republican is, probably Charlie Baker.
I am assuming that.
Yeah, and there's an independent, too. Let's not
Several.
Forget him. That's right. Well, do you want to go down the list, Jim?
There are three independents.
Okay.
But go ahead.
Would you like to list them?
No.
Okay. Okay. Let's assume you win.
Yeah.
What's the most important thing you think you would the top of your priority that you would like to assume as the successor to Governor Deval Patrick?
Well, the biggest thing we have to do as a Commonwealth is create tens of thousands of jobs. So that doesn't happen overnight. But all through our gateway cities, there's still 10% plus unemployment. And, I've been in 155 cities and towns, and all of them many, many times. They're not recovering on their own. So the next governor's got to focus on this, or the divide gets too great. It's got to be based on new kinds of businesses and industries, which means new job skills. And the second thing, it's really hand in hand with it, so I can't really tease them apart, is to close the achievement gap in the poorer performing schools. Every year there's another cohort of kids on a bridge to nowhere in the poorer performing schools.
You know, I read a depressing story about my own hometown, Fall River, the other day that talked about only 14% of the people in Fall River have college degrees. Many people have no high school degrees.
So 35% don't have a high school degree.
35%
in Fall River. Yeah.
That's pretty bad. So what can you do? I mean, that's a real huge
It is. It's a huge issue that is holding the city back. Absolutely, and you know, there's a history there because you know, in that, there was a mill, it was a textile town, mill town, and people grew up, and you know, generation after generation didn't really believe they needed to finish high school. They went into the mills. Of course, that's all gone, and that's never coming back. And the modern industries, you at least have to have an adequate high school education. So, I think you have to start with the building blocks of things you know work, and they have at-risk and poor-performing schools in Fall River. I've been there many times. And you do have to fund in those schools. It's my highest priority with a special fund I'm going to create at, you know, pre-K to make a higher percentage more literate at the third grade and lengthening the school day and remaking it with academic support and enrichment. So you have to do the things we know work, but we have to do it. And it's beyond individual school districts. I think the state has to really focus on this. And Fall River isn't alone, of course, but it's a great example of where it's hard to bring new skills, new jobs, if you don't have an adequate high school base there, and they definitely need that.
I think I said it backwards. Did I say only 14%?
14% don't have a higher education. Only 14% have a higher education.
Yeah,
that's
I said
correct.
It backwards. Excuse
Joe
me.
Avalone, there's some people who think that the solution to problems of unemployment in major cities in Massachusetts is the plop a casino down in them. The people of Springfield obviously feel that way. People in Revere feel that way. People in Everett feel that way. A lot of other places don't. Are casinos part of the answer for the jobs that don't exist?
Not really. I mean, they're good construction jobs for those that might get built. But basically, for the long run, you need, for sustainable jobs, you need these new industries. That's what's going to create the good paying jobs that is going to bring more people into the middle class and continue to grow and support our middle class, which is what's sorely needed here.
Does that mean you don't support casinos? Or where are you in this thing? Assuming the Supreme Judicial Court says that the voters can decide whether we should have a casino law come November, how do you vote and why?
Well, I don't favor casinos overall. I think it was oversold. The revenue was oversold. It's also going to be a bricks and mortar dinosaur as everything moves to online over 10 years. And the costs were undersold. So there's some good upfront jobs. But I like the law. We do have a law that does allow for local control. Each community can decide. Communities are deciding. And so I would go out with the law. I don't like the referendum because I don't like referendum government, period.
You don't like the people having a say in whether or not the casino law should exist?
Say. They elected a legislature. The legislature worked through a complicated problem, came up with this law. Generally,
but how can you say, with all due respect, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly against casinos when their boss was Sal DeMacy, who was against casinos.
Yeah.
64 of the very same reps who had voted no 2 years later had an epiphany and voted yes. Why? Because the new speaker favored casinos, Bob DeLeo. That's not the best of democracy. That's not representing your constituents, is it? It's essentially being responsible to your boss, the speaker.
Well, if you look at it at a higher level, I think we do have a legislature. It does pass laws. That's what we should stick with. I don't say that there shouldn't be a referendum. I just say, personally, I wouldn't support it because I don't think we should be overturning recently passed laws generally. I think that sets up a terrible planning climate for all kinds of businesses, puts a chill on business here. And ultimately, we've got to create a lot of jobs, so it's got to be a good business climate here.
There's also going to be, if assuming they get the signatures, a ballot question on the gas tax.
Yeah.
Where are you on the ballot question for the gas tax?
Well, I favor the gas tax. We definitely need a dedicated fund for infrastructure, but I don't favor indexing. I think indexing is a backdoor tax. People resent it. Ultimately, it'll get overturned. I think leadership is going back when you need more, and we are going to need more. There's going to be future probably gas tax increases, maybe tolling. Electronic tolling increases to fund our needed infrastructure. We have a huge backlog because of the big dig, largely. But I don't think we should have an automatic escalator. I think people really resent that, and I don't blame them. I think real leadership for the governor and the legislature is to stand up and make the case. They should do that, and I would do that as governor as needed.
We're talking to Joe Avalone, who's one of the five Democrats who is hoping to get on the ballot in mid-June for the September primary. I've read a few places, Joe, that you describe yourself as a fiscal moderate.
Yeah.
What does that mean in English? I mean, you just told us you're against indexing of the gas tax. We should be clear, the ballot question wouldn't repeal the gas tax. It would repeal the indexing portion that I believe you're the only Democrat who would vote yes on that particular question, at least as far as I understand.
Yes.
But you said there will need to be some toll or tax increases, at which point you go to the people, go to their legislators. What makes you a fiscal moderate? You're not taking a no tax pledge. What makes you a fiscal moderate?
Well, I'm not advocating a broad-based tax, income tax increase, which all my other opponents are for one way or another, because I know there's this huge opportunity to control our healthcare costs that creates hundreds of millions of dollars in the budget that we should, with that we should, that's where we should spend our effort and time. I know that at $36 billion, if we even lowered the percentage of revenue, which is now at 40% of the state budget that goes to healthcare, if it was 39%, that's $350 million. And it's well within our range. We know there's $29 billion in wasted care that doesn't add to health outcomes by our own Health Policy Commission. Just a fraction of that, which is I know we can do, can save hundreds of millions of dollars in the budget. I'm the only candidate that's actually controlled health care costs and lowered them in this state. I was the CEO of Blue Cross in the 90s. We did control health care costs during that decade. And I know that our system is so fragmented, redundant, and inefficient that there's enormous potential. The other candidates don't seem to have a grasp of that. They don't really know the potential because I don't think they've sat in the seat I've sat in. And I know, so therefore, they're advocating tax increases. We don't need a tax increase. We need to control our healthcare costs. And if I could just add, it's the biggest budget busters in cities and towns. It's the biggest inhibitor of small businesses. So controlling our healthcare costs creates a lot of opportunity all across the board in Massachusetts.
Do you think Charlie Baker around Harvard Pilgrim knows anything about healthcare?
He does, but on his watch, he increased premiums about 10% a year plus, compounding over about a decade. So that wasn't exactly controlling healthcare costs.
Joe, you have a convention in Worcester mid-June. And the conventional wisdom goes as follows. Since Marjorie's the cup half full, asking what you'll do as governor, I'll be the cup half empty. The conventional wisdom is that Grossman, the treasurer, and Coakley, the attorney general, get their, quote, 15%, that you need 15% of delegates at the vote to put you on the primary ballot, that Kayyem and Juliette Kayyem and Don Berwick have a shot. You are the least likely of the five. Why is conventional wisdom wrong as to you?
Well, conventional wisdom seems to be in a bubble with just a few people talking to each other. I've been
like me and Marjorie, for example.
That's
exactly
right.
What you're talking about.
Maybe you need to get out. Get out a few other times. I've got endorsements from 22 mayors and city councilors, the second most endorsements of anybody beyond Steve, I think. And I'm proud because it's mayors and city councilors, mostly in the Gateway Cities. So it's Worcester, mayor and four city councilors. It's three city councilors in Quincy. It's the mayor of Taunton, city councilors in Fall River, some city councilors in Boston, so on and on. And why that's important is those are the cities. That's where Democrats win elections. They're a little more moderate and conservative as Democrats, but it's the center of the Democratic Party. And there's a lot more uncommitted delegates still in those areas. So I know I'm on the ballot. I know I'm getting on the ballot.
You're upset about the 15% rule. And for those who don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not even sure I'm right. The 15% rule, it says, again, you have to get 15% of the delegates to vote for you to make it on the primary ballot. My understanding is what upsets you. Why don't you say what upsets you rather than me trying to characterize your position?
Well, I think the rule that we are living with now, the one ballot rule.
You have to get it on the first ballot.
You have to get it on one ballot. Came into effect in 2006. And so in 2006, there were three contenders, Deval, Tom Riley, and Chris Gabriel. They all got on. It wasn't a contested convention 4 years later. Deval was running around a post. So this is the first time now that we're faced with the one ballot with now five pretty legitimate contenders. So if the Democrats end up cleaving off some of those and not allowing the full Democratic Party to vet what are pretty five reasonable characters, I think we're making a mistake. I think we're not only making a mistake because that doesn't seem fair to the larger Democratic Party, and I don't think it's going to look like we're the inclusive party. I also don't think that I think I'm the only moderate in the race, frankly, and we're going to leave a big part of the Democratic Party behind. I think all my other opponents are moving to the left continuously and trying to appease a small part of the party which goes to this convention, which are mostly progressives. And I think that leaves a big part of our party kind of without a candidate, even in the primary, if I don't get on. Luckily, I'm getting on, but I think why take that risk? Why did we set ourselves up this
way? Would you be happier if there was no nominating, there was no 15% threshold, that if you essentially get, 10,000 signatures, that you're on the ballot? Is that...
No, I respect the idea that we have a convention. I think that's good. It's good for the party. And I even respect the idea that we want people that have been vetted pretty heavily. So I could see two possible options. One is go back to the two ballots. Basically, when we had two ballots, and that could have happened this time, most credible candidates find their way on in the second ballot, by the second ballot. When there's one and five candidates, that's what sets up the math problem. I think another thing would be lower the threshold to 10%, but I'd favor the two ballots. The reason the party wanted to move away from that is they thought the 2002 convention was messy and it took a long time. Hey, it's a small price to pay to get it right, to offer good candidates to the larger electorate.
We're talking to Joe Avalon, who's running for governor on the Democratic side. You just mentioned that you are more moderate than the other Democrats are running, that they're further to the left than you are. And you mentioned the income tax, that they want an income tax. What else? What else distinguishes you from the other four?
Well, for example, on health care, I know we can control health care costs. We have a great system with universal coverage. We put it in place 7 years ago. It's a success story. We got 98% people covered. What we should be focusing on now is controlling health care costs, making this delivery system more efficient. That was always meant to be step two. We should carry on with that. All of my competitors are talking about single payer. Let's move to single payer. That's a political, ideological battle that opens up a whole can of worms that'll take our eye off the ball for the next 5 years, literally, while we're sorting that out, versus getting on with controlling our health care costs.
Who's talking about single payer besides Don Berwick? Don Berwick is an unabashed single payer guy, former head of Center of Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid, whichever it is. Who else is embracing single payer amongst the other three?
Everyone else, I'm in forums with them all the time. Everyone else has said we ought to look at it, we ought to be thinking about it, we ought to study it. Steve wants to convene a meeting. I guess he wants to be the chief convener. But they're all talking about it. I think it's wasted energy, and we should really get on to controlling health care costs.
Is there anything else that distinguishes you from the other four?
Well, those are two pretty big things.
I'm
liberal on the social issue,
okay.
So this is really around fiscal moderation.
Okay.
So Deval Patrick, in the minds of most, has had a fairly tough year in his final year, from the DCF issues, Department of Children and Families, to the rollout of medical marijuana, to the chaos in the Casino Commission, on and on. How would you rate Deval Patrick's 7-plus years in the office in Massachusetts?
Well, first of all, the context, he's in the seventh year of an 8-year time, and of course, that's always hard on anybody. And second of all, we had a terrible recession and a really slow and uneven recovery. So that was the playing field he was on. I think he had a very exciting and correct vision for the Commonwealth when he started out, and I think that's still the correct vision. I think the next governor needs to take on the big implementation steps of this. He talked about new jobs and new industries. He talked about improving education, and that means the education. He talked about controlling healthcare costs. That was Chapter 224. You need now somebody who's managed large organizations, in my view, that can take on the next big steps of that vision. We don't need a new vision. We need to continue on with.
But how would you describe? How would you characterize him as a manager, particularly in year seven on these issues that the public has become pretty consumed with?
Disappointed, but it's not just him. We haven't had a manager that's run large organizations in the governor's office for a long time, so there's not a management culture there. And I actually can't wait for that part of the job. I mean, this is what I do. I know that we can instill a better management culture there, so there's more accountability, more metrics, more focus on just the key things we need to get done, instead of allowing just a bureaucracy to roll forward. So if you add the lack of a management culture with the terrible recession, you start seeing some of the failures that we've now seen.
Okay, you have 30 seconds. Yeah. All I want to know is, and you can't say
seconds,
it's
actually
meeting the voters, what's been the highlight of your race and what's been the torturous thing when you go home at night, you say, I can't believe I got to do this again. What's the good and the bad? Tell the truth.
The good is the amazing diversity of our state, which is so small. For a small state, it's just incredibly diverse. The regions are diverse. Of course, the ethnicity is diverse. What people care about is diverse. You would expect it to be a much larger state with that amount of diversity. That's fascinating.
Okay, now raise your right hand for the bad part. I want to make sure you're telling the truth. He has raised his right hand. What's the part that's driving you crazy?
Well, his anybody that says they like fundraising has got to have a
screen. Okay, that's an honest answer.
So I definitely don't like fundraising. But
Joe,
it's part of the job for sure.
What's your website, Joe?
It's avalonforgovernor.com. Thank you for asking.
Great to see you, Joe.
Joe,
good
thank
luck
you so much for coming
June.
In. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Joe Avalon is running for governor on the Democratic ticket. And again, thank you so much for being here. Up next, it's time for Open Mic with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, Lynn, City of Shoes. Edgar B. Herrick III has a report from our Curiosity Desk. Tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
I'm Joe Bergantino, the executive director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
I'm Jennifer McKim.
I'm Rupa Shenoy.
I'm Beth Daly, a reporter.
A reporter.
A reporter with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
Now a partner in the WGBH newsroom.
WGBH Radio exists thanks to you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers and appraisers, supporting American Public Media's business and economic news show, Marketplace, weekdays from 6 to 6:30 p.m. on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as he does every Thursday, is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. And as Marjorie and I do every Thursday morning, as you know, we marvel that his name is Alex Beam. Why did we marvel this morning? Do you remember, Marjorie? Well, I'll tell you. Thank you. Because Marjorie said this, because like a sunbeam hairdryer, Alex, his hot wit annihilates all that annoying static electricity in the air. That's what Marjorie said verbatim. I wrote it down.
That's a very female image, right?
That's right. That's right.
How are you?
48. Thanks for asking.
Thank you. He's well.
Like
he's
I care.
Looking fine. He's looking fine. So, Alex, I can't wait to talk to you about the smackdown between Amazon and Hachette. Please explain to our listeners what is going on.
Or Hachette.
Hachette?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I've said Hachette forever.
No, it's a huge French conglomerate.
Excuse me. Hachette.
It's originally
Libre. Should I say Hachette?
All right, that's enough.
What was it originally?
Librairie Hachette.
Of course,
it was just a small.
I look like a real. Do I look like a real rube? I guess is
you
that
are,
the expression.
Yes. What is this set to about, please?
Well, it's just Hachette is one of. You know how the accounting firms used to be the Big Eight, and now they're the Big Four or something. So there's five companies that dominate U.S. publishing, and they're all struggling with Amazon because Amazon has incredible market power. So everyone is sort of trying to take a small amount of commission or fee or discount from everyone else's piece of the pie. And in this instance, in this particular Amazon versus the publisher Hachette, which owns Little Brown, I mean, it's a very well-known American publisher.
By the way, it's Littell and Brown. This, I believe, yeah. The proper
or Petit Brun, as we call
Petit
it.
Petit Brun. That's right.
Sorry. Whoa. Bring on the Cambridge accent.
Yeah.
Little Brown, you know, famous. You know, Michael Connelly, James Patterson, million-selling authors. In this instance, there's a direct conflict over royalties for electronic book payments. And, I mean, if you think in terms of a Jim Patterson, I would guess he sells, let's just say, maybe 1.4 million ebooks a year, which is a lot. Let's say they're priced at $5. That's Amazon sets that price. And Amazon and Hachette now cannot agree on a royalty scheme. Just for example, for James Patterson's electronic book downloads. And this is a lot of money when we're talking about a huge publisher's sales.
So, and essentially, Hachette is taking it out. Amazon is taking it out on Hachette by essentially increasing the delivery time for their books, so they're less attractive. If you click on a Hachette book, you're told that, well, there may be a better choice that more suits your purposes in some cases. And thirdly, they're not even listing some books that are on the horizon. They're basically at war with Hachette, which is causing some people to urge boycotts of Amazon. Is that what they're saying?
Well, I literally first learned of this about 8 days ago from a Facebook posting by Scott Turow, a former head of the Authors Guild, of which I'm a member, I might as well say. And, you know, Scott Turow is a real broad-shouldered writer, right? He wrote
Harvard Law School. What was that called?
1L.
Thank you very much.
His first book was a bestseller. Yes. Presumed Innocent is a masterpiece. And I'm told others do. So I read this, and he said, I'm boycotting Amazon. And I even left a comment, to the thrust of which was, boy, that's easy for you to say, Scott. I mean, you're Scott Turow. There's a lot of things that are being lost here. There are thousands of authors, if not tens of thousands of authors, for whom Amazon is a godsend. And there's even the Scott Turows of the world. I can't speak for him. But you know, I was just at an event for my friend Joe Finder, has a big sort of thriller coming out. And we talked confidentially. I'm not going to paraphrase what he told me. But, I mean, a writer like Joe Finder with a big thriller is going to be selling a lot of books on Amazon, a lot of electronic books, a very high percentage of sales on Amazon. A mid-list writer, a quote-unquote small writer like me, is going to be selling a lot of books on Amazon. And then there's even a category of writer we haven't discussed, you know, self-published writers. Amazon has been very hospitable to self-published writers.
Is it inappropriate for me? It isn't the conclusion, but as soon as I heard about these punitive tactics being employed by Amazon against Hachette, I said to myself, which may be, again, completely inappropriate, and this guy is the publisher, is the owner of the Washington Post. Should that not trouble me? I mean, sort of in the Amazon context, the dog-eat-dog world of business, I say, well, yeah, I don't like it, but it's okay. Should it bother me that... Okay, he is also the editor that owns the Post?
It's hugely relevant.
How so?
That he's the owner of the Washington
Post. Owner, yeah.
Post.
How is it relevant?
Well, let me just...
Jeff Bezos.
There's a bit of a... You know, this thing about Amazon's punitive tactics. There's been a bit of a conspiracy by the New York Times and the New Yorker to blacken Amazon. Amazon is a ferocious and intelligent competitor, not an enemy of the book trade, as that lengthy George Packer article in The New Yorker made out. And in this latest, now the Times has printed at least two articles already. Not every fact in these articles is true. This is pretty sophisticated stuff. Joshua Ferris, for instance, is a Hachette novelist, Little Brown novelist, has a book out right now. You can go buy it. Get it delivered in 2 days. You can get it electronically. So this is pretty sophisticated stuff. Books that are currently on sale are, in fact, available through Amazon. I come at this from a slightly different perspective. I think it's fascinating that Jeff Bezos is the owner of the Washington Post, because this means that I think an extremely enlightened kind of tooth and nail type competitor has taken over a major American newspaper. I blather endlessly. I mean, there's just three really interesting things happening. Bezos at the Post, John Henry at the Globe, and the kind of floundering Sulzberger dynasty. If you were playing a game of horse race, you'd say, boy, I might put my money on Bezos and the Washington Post.
You know, I was in Chicago the other day, and I actually sold one of your books. American Crucifixion is a great book about the murder of Joseph Smith,
founder
of
the Mormon Church. Yeah.
But when you click on American Crucifixion on Amazon, you know what it says? Wouldn't you prefer Catcher in the Rye? That is really,
you know, that was one of the points, is what Amazon is doing. Hachette.
Yeah.
Okay, but do they have a point about what is their point? What is their argument? What is their defense?
Whose defense?
Hachette.
They want more money,
they
right?
They want more money.
But I mean, is it legitimate wanting more money? Are they
negotiation. I mean, let's say I wanted $500 every time I walked into your studio.
Okay.
And you two said, no, $210. Well, we would have a disagreement. Who is one of us right or wrong? I mean,
I think usually one of them is closer to a reasonable price. That's what I'm trying to get at here.
You're really asking, are they being unfair in their demands? Is that not where you're going? Yeah.
No, I mean, it is the part of the story that the Times got right is that this is a death struggle. It turns out that it's like many negotiations, it's a domino negotiation. In other words, whatever Hachette agrees to as a percentage of electronic book royalties that it will turn over to Amazon, that will in effect be binding on the other four major publishers.
Okay, now, Alex, occasionally you take a hit at people who you might consider friends. For example, you've written very negative things
nasty
about me
things,
and Marjorie in the past, which
right.
we're not going to get
for
into.
For which I've apologized 100 times.
Should we consider the fact that you have written, I've done an accounting of this in recent times, you've written about Tenebrae. You've written about Pope envy. You've written about whether or not there's any hell. You've written about the outdoor church of Cambridge. You've also obviously written American Crucifixion, your great book. Assume that this is a naked bid to get John Allen's job at the Boston Globe, who is the chief? What is with you in religion?
Father Guido Sartucci.
Really, in all seriousness.
That's what he wants to be, Guido Sartucci.
What is with you? Every other column is about
religion. He's a searcher and a seeker. Isn't it obvious?
What is today? Today is Trolling for Souls. What's the latest religion installment in the Alex Bean collection? What is
I think my editors are really beginning to wonder. You forgot that I wrote a column about online communion. Union, actually.
Oh, that's I did forget about that.
Yeah.
That's
okay,
right.
So what's
and
this one about?
Outdoor, and that outdoor place.
I said that. Outdoor Church of Cambridge, yeah.
Well, this is, I don't know. This caught my interest because on June 8th, I mean, I have a fairly complicated and low opinion, I guess. On June 8th, there's going to be a social media thunderclap where everybody is on that at some specific time is going to tweet, Instagram, text message, and email their love for Jesus Christ on June 8th. So don't miss that.
Thunderclap. Is
Thunderclap.
That what it's called?
Okay. Yeah. And it's sort of, it just, it, I didn't make it sound quite as absurd in the column as I perhaps should have, but I had a revelation, yikes, if you will. I realized that for a certain generation, and this is a really trite comment, you know, things are being experienced on the internet.
Correct.
You know, and that's a really trite observation. For me, it's heinous that a religious experience would happen on the internet, but I'm the outlier here in a way. And then I did actually bring this back to this one bizarre fact that was rattling around in my empty brain, which is sort of fascinating to me, which is that those two men in dark suits, the Mormon missionaries who knock on your door and offer you the Book of Mormon, have been effectively supplanted in the Mormon religion by computers in Provo, Utah. In other words, the Mormon Church...
This is real.
This is for real. The Mormon Church, which is very data-driven, sort of like, you know, Bainey's, like Mitt Romney, very data-driven, very results-oriented, has realized, in a nutshell, that they can proselytize better over the internet, get better results of spreading their missionary gospel over the internet than they can knocking on doors.
But, you know, that makes to me perfect sense in 2014, because really not that many people want to open their doors to people, two men standing there in black suits anymore. I used to live across the street from a Jehovah's Witnesses church. Believe me, they were always coming over with the Kingdom, whatever that is, that publication of theirs, and driving
Watchtower,
whatever
right,
it is. I mean, we were like the first hit every single solitary day. It was out of control.
Do you remember the Saturday Night Live thing where the land shark comes through?
Of course, yes.
Instead of the
land
Jehovah's
shark,
Witness.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a Jehovah's Witness.
And so, you know, the converts one click away. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, but To deepen my foxhole
convert
of triteness, I think the thing that my generation, someone my age, can't understand is that people are making these extremely sincere connections, over the internet, and indeed, you know, committing themselves to spiritual inquiry with people they've never met and may never meet. I mean, the Mormons are converting, in some sense, you know, some instances are converting people they've never met, that they've only chatted with, so to speak, and have asked for blah, blah, blah.
Now, June 8th, as we all knew, even before Alex told us, is the date of Thunderclap.
Thunderclap.
Obviously, and it's on my calendar.
Of course.
June 12th is what, Alex Beam? And we know this is very important to you, which most people don't know. This is one of your obsessions. What happens on June 12th?
This is one of my obsessions, and we've talked about this over the years. The Blinking World Cup is starting in Brazil, and I'm so, so psyched.
Now, in violation of, I think, our unspoken rules, as you know, near the end of Alex's weekly engagements here, we do an explainer. What he does is takes a relatively complex topic and in 45 seconds or less attempts to explain it to us, sometimes moderately successfully, sometimes not. The thing that I think violates the whole concept is Alex actually proposed his own explainer today.
It's not like anybody else came up with
ideas.
No,
we didn't. That's true. Now, here is what Alex emailed to us that he would like to do in 45 seconds or left, because he will not be here with us on the week he's away, on the week that the World Cup begins in Brazil, correct? Is that
correct.
Right?
I'll be in Zion, in fact. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Okay, here it is. And what he emailed is, he said he would like to explain why the U.S. yet again will soil the bed at the World Cup starting June 12th. So are you ready for this?
I could say this in like 10 seconds.
Well, do whatever. You can start right now. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I've always despised the United States in the World Cup. I'm always rooting against them. And it's always been a very safe bet that they will hardly ever get to the round of 16. Oh, I think they did get to the round of 16 last time, where they were brutally eliminated by Ghana. But now they're in a group of death. So people who are negative and pessimistic and anti-patriotic like myself are just reveling in the fact that there's no way they can beat Germany, Portugal, or even Ghana. The other
is that in their bracket or
whatever? Yeah, in their group
sorry,
of death. There's four nations are in each group. There's two groups of death, actually, but the United States is in one of them. Hilariously, I'm sure this will ultimately cost the German coach, Jürgen Klinsmann, his job, because he's widely despised anyway. Mm. He's sort of this prima donna from Germany who, of all things, has been bringing Germans onto the American team under some kind of false flag. These are actual people living in Germany whose fathers were GIs. It's a scandal.
So do you tell people, that was okay. Now, do you tell people not to call you? How long is the World Cup going? For like a month or something? How long is it going for?
Yeah, at least a month, yeah.
And do you tell people, don't call me, don't write, don't bother me? That's the month I'll be sitting in front of
the television. I don't have one of those fancy Prime cable packages, so I'm sort of dependent on just, I just watch what I can. You know, I don't watch
but
every
don't
game.
But don't you think it changed somewhat last time around? I heard and saw all sorts of people talking about the World Cup last time around, looking at all these soccer players, and I thought it was more interest.
Yeah. No, there's definitely more. I mean, many would say, by the way, that the Women's World Cup paved the way in marketing terms for the eventual, because we beat China, I guess, 8 years ago, or excuse me, maybe 10 years ago in Women's World Cup.
The Brandy Chastain.
Okay, I'm going to read. Enough for you. I'm going to read from your column.
Enough from me. Really. What the hell?
I'm going to read from your column in the New York Times in 2010. The last
I don't even
World
write
Cup.
For the New York Times.
Well, actually,
ridiculous.
You did at that particular time. He recites some of the Brazilian soccer names, which obviously he's enamored of. And then he writes about what he calls the white shoe law firm names of the Americans. He says,
oh, no.
He writes, this is Alex. Who are you going to fall in love with? Nice white boys from California in the mid-Atlantic states, suburbs, or the funky futbolistas of the favelas?
Oh.
It's not just the Brazilians. Listen to what he writes. It's not just the Brazilians. The current English national team, writes Alex Beam, is a hotbed of wife and girlfriend swapping intrigue.
Wow.
Yeah, I haven't seen an American footballer on the front page of the New York Post, well, ever. And by the way, did David Beckham play for us? Did he not? Or he played for England?
He played for England. I'm so ignorant. I don't know. Those who call you WAGs, wives and girlfriends, they have really amazing stuff in Britain.
Wasn't there a star last time? What's the name of the guy who was the goal scorer who actually was quite good for the United States, who became a minor phenomenon in the United States? What was that guy's name?
He was such a phenomenon, we all missed
him.
No,
he was actually a pretty big deal, wasn't he?
Well, I'm so embarrassed. Clint Dempsey was our best player. And
maybe
it was Landon Donovan who just
got cut. Landon Donovan.
Well, he just got cut, so I mean.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
He didn't make this team?
You got to wake up, Jim.
Oh, my God.
And by the way, I deny writing whatever that was.
Well, it's you. It's
But I have to say, everyone's really watching this guy, Suarez, whom you can see, I just saw the video this morning. Suarez bit an opponent in the penalty area. It's really hilarious. I think he's a striker. I know he's a striker for Liverpool, but I think he's from Portugal. He'll be playing for the Portuguese.
Is that not allowed?
Biting?
I don't know. I don't.
It's allowed in the studio, but it's not allowed in the penalty zone.
Okay, before you go, getting back, how is American Crucifixion, your fine book, doing? I'm serious. What are you laughing about? How is it doing, American Crucifixion?
You know, I have literally never checked. I will wait for the
that
6 months.
That is not true.
It is 100% truth, as God is my witness.
How about in Utah?
I'm going to Utah. I'm very excited.
Are you?
I'm really excited.
I mean, I would think it would be, that's an obvious place for it to be flying off the shelves.
Well, it's
or Belmont, one of the two.
Belmont.
I've literally never looked at an Amazon ranking. I have no idea how it's sold. I know that it's sold out at the Brigham Young University bookstore.
That's great.
Which had ordered five copies.
Oh.
Okay, so I sold five copies.
Oh.
No, they'll be restocking.
Too self-deprecating.
Okay.
So, Alex, it's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Good luck. Watch the World Cup. You'll really, really
enjoy
it.
I will watch the World Cup. Well, they're fine athletes, are they not? They're fun to watch them in action.
Landon Donovan was cut. Did you know that?
I did not know that, Jim. I didn't even know how to say hatchet, so there you go. I thought it was hatchet. Alex Beam is a columnist. Excuse me, I was going to say communist. He's not a communist for the Boston Globe. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe. His new book, as Jim just said, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Up next, Jonathan Alsop, founder of the Boston Wine School, joins us to talk about tricks of the trade, literally, like how you can uncork a bottle of wine with your shoe. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, why David Foster Wallace may have delivered the best commencement address ever. If you missed it on Boston Public Radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Every year, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to land some hot deals, and every winning bid supports the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
Support for our programs comes from you. And Xconomy.com, presenting Boston 2034 on June 10th, exploring the ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the economy in the years to come. More at Xconomy.com/Boston2034. And Mass Eye and Ear, sense life, experience life. When ear, nose, and throat problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit MassEyeandEar.org for more information.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to talk about everything from climate change to how to MacGyver a cork bottle of wine. He's laughing right now. Without a corkscrew is Jonathan Alsop. As you know, Jonathan is the founder of the Boston Wine School and the author of Wine Lover's Devotional, 365 Days of Knowledge, Advice, and Lore for the Ardent Aficionado. Hello there, Jonathan.
Hello, Jonathan. Good
Jim
to see you.
And Marjorie,
as
good
always.
To see you.
Well, I can't wait to talk to you about music and wine.
Yes.
Because many people, I've tried to do this myself. You know, when you go out to a dinner and you order a bottle of wine, and the guy comes over and he pours some wine in your glass, and you know, I pretend I have some remote clue of whether it's good or bad, or what, I have no idea, but I swish it around, try to look official.
Wet.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But tell us the effect that this story talks about, the effect of music on what you think about wine.
So, a couple of things. First of all, 100 years ago, when I first started writing about wine, there was this guy in Michigan who kept sending me Excel spreadsheets of different wine tastings that he was doing with, I don't know, other people who were not receiving the healthcare services that they needed. And he would send me these, and he would have the same wine with different music, and he had all of these correlations between a California red Zinfandel tastes best when you listen to it to ZZ Top or some other kind of Texas boogie, some sort of Southern boogie. And it was just, I thought this was crazy. But the guy kept emailing me and sending me things. I finally learned how to use my blacklist on my email, so I was able to block him. But years later, now we have something that is like apparently quasi official. This is Wine and Song, the Effect of Background Music on the Taste of Wine. And this is from a university in Edinburgh. I know I'm pronouncing this wrong. Harriet Watt.
It sounds good to me.
Harriet
That's the best
Watt
I could do
University.
Too, yeah.
So what they did in this study, and guys, can we get some wine glasses in here? Because I want to do a little science while we're tasting wine.
Okay, sure,
they're on their way.
With me. Okay, beautiful. So what they did is they identified essentially four types of wine, four types of music, powerful and heavy, subtle and refined, zingy and refreshing, mellow and soft.
Right.
So these were the four music classes. And so what they did is they had people taste wine without any music and then asked them to describe the wine. And then they had not the same group but a different uncontrolled group taste the same wine, you know, for instance, while the powerful and heavy music was playing. And they found that people who were listening to powerful, heavy wine, people listening to powerful, heavy music while tasting white wine, red wine, whatever, in the case of red wine, 60% more likely to describe the wine as powerful and heavy.
The same wine,
between no music and powerful and heavy music. And all of the correlations relate to all of the different styles. So I want you guys to taste this first. This is a Spanish white wine.
You want us to taste it with no music?
Yeah, taste it with no music first. We're going to taste it with no music, and then we're going to taste it with two different kinds of music, and then see if our perceptions of it are any different.
Am I supposed to roll it around the glass like
you
see everybody doing in the restaurant?
What?
Or does it make absolutely
you know
no
what?
Difference?
These are the finest
plastic cups.
These are the finest plastic cups available.
Correct.
If you can swirl it around, I'd say go for it.
Okay.
But these are just really to get the wine, you know, from the table to your mouth. It's very basic sort of
delicious.
Sort of
it's
thing.
Actually quite nice.
Okay.
Okay.
White wine
next?
From Spain. It's called, the grape is called Verdejo.
Okay.
And in Spanish, Verdejo means greenish.
Okay.
And this wine's very sort of,
it's actually quite nice.
Sort of spring-like and
spring-like.
Green and zippy.
Guys, fine bouquet.
Yes. Yeah, so do we have the first music queued up? Well, so guys, get some wine in your mouth and then you guys play the music and tell us what your reaction is now. Okay.
And who are we listening to?
Well,
and we're told that's Mozart. Is that
how's it taste?
Should we taste now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think, Marjorie?
It is true.
Yeah.
It tastes much more expensive with the Mozart going
expensive.
On. It's absolutely true.
More organized.
Yeah. More mathematical.
More mathematical, more clarity.
Absolutely.
Okay. Can I tell you, also, yeah. by the way, yeah. this is really true.
Yeah.
I mean,
it really,
I was cynical about this when people said, like, they're hypnotized. Yeah. You know they're not.
No. Oh, my God.
It really does taste different.
The power of the placebo effect and suggestion is just unbelievable. So let's go to the second piece of music. Okay, guys, get a little wine in your mouth, and now let's get the second piece of music going. Yeah. All right. So what are you feeling now?
Thunderbird. We're drinking Thunderbird.
Drinking Thunderbird. Okay.
A little less refined.
Now, do you guys know,
less refined. Absolutely less refined.
By the way, in all seriousness, I'm sure people in their cars or at home saying, or in the office saying, this is ridiculous.
No, it's really happening.
There really is
a
qualitative difference. It does taste
so you buy it. You buy this.
You know what? Probably about 5 or 6 years ago, Stanford did this fantastic study. You know what an MRI?
Yes.
You know where
they touch
your brain.
Yes.
There's a type of MRI called fMRI, which stands for functional MRI. Essentially, they put a helmet on you and you do stuff while they look at.
Have you done that, Jim? With a helmet?
Your brain.
Actually, I have.
Okay.
Not that it's anybody's business, I have.
So what they? I'm feeling sorry. I brought this up.
It's okay.
What they did is they gave people the same wine, and told them that it was different prices. And then watched the pleasure centers of their brains react to the same wine.
So there's a physiological change as well?
So now we're having a ghost in the machine kind of conversation. But when the same wine got more expensive from $10 to $20 to in the 40s and 60s, the pleasure center of the people's brains flashed more broadly and more vigorously with the same wine with a higher price tag, up to $68.
Okay.
And at $68, people started to say, wait a minute, that's too much. And then it started to go the other way, you know, that as the wine got more and more expensive, people liked it less because they were like, $100, crazy.
So here's the question, Jonathan, since this is your business, you operate the Boston Wine School, you're trying many different wines. Can you tell the difference between a good wine and a cheap wine? Or are you, if we put on a little Bach fugue, are you totally seduced?
Just as we were able to tell the difference between Mozart and Justin Bieber, even if you can't sing or play a musical instrument or have no musical training, you can tell the difference between those two musics. And I think it's the same thing with wine. I mean, I think a $5 wine, a $10 wine, a $100 wine, you can – I mean, I think that when people sit down, they can taste the difference between those two things. Do you necessarily like the more expensive wine more? There's very little correlation between price in a blind tasting world where you don't know the price.
Right.
One of my favorite groups is the American – I talk about this, I know, every time I'm on – the American Association of Wine Economists. They did a huge study in blind tastings, correlating blind taste with the price of wine. And what they found is that there's almost no correlation between the price of a bottle of wine and how much you like it. And what little correlation there is slightly negative. So that in fact, as wines get more expensive, the tendency is to – it doesn't mean they're not better wine. They can be better wine. They can be more elaborate wine. But people, regular people like us, as wine gets more expensive, tend to like it less.
Well, when it gets really expensive. But there's that middle range, which is what I thought you were describing before, when people think it's better even if they can't tell that it's better because the price is a little slightly elevated.
Right, because what kind of world are we living in?
Speaking of world that we live in, you know what the world we live in is, Jonathan Alsop? A world without corkscrews. Now, well, I'm assuming you don't go anywhere without corkscrews.
So great.
Everybody I know, including me, Marjorie, I assume even you, have had a situation where you have a bottle of wine, you've been holding it, you're taking it to wherever you're going, you're waiting for the moment that you can finally crack it open, and of course you can't because you don't have a corkscrew. Then we watched a video this morning that shows that it's the most basic elementary way
insane?
To open a wine bottle. Describe what this is.
Okay.
It is beautiful.
Well, okay, so we've all come up against this where we've got a bottle of wine, we don't have a corkscrew. How do you get it open? A lot of different techniques. Of course, there's the you know, pushing the cork into the bottle technique, which we've all done.
How do you push it in with what?
Oh, just with whatever, with a screwdriver, okay, or a ballpoint
pen. But then
pin.
It ruins all, and then the, oh, yeah, the then pieces of the cork,
oh, yeah,
go all
mess,
in place,
and it splashes
and it's horrible,
out.
Yeah.
Another thing you can do is if you've got like an eye hook or some kind of like a ceiling hook, like you can screw that into the bottle,
oh,
and then grab the ceiling hook and yank
those
it out.
Plant things.
Marjorie,
plant,
how often do you have a ceiling
hanger
hook with you? That doesn't help. I mean, what are you saying?
Look,
oh, that's
in
great.
In my pocket every day.
Just trying to be helpful.
Okay.
So now these people, so this group, this is Mirambeau Vineyards from the south of France. These people in the video, which I have not tried this because, you know, I'm in a, you know, a corkscrew rich environment.
I'm trying,
you know, at all times.
But just describe it.
But what you do is you take the capsule off.
Right.
The capsule
is the foil,
the
like
plastic,
the foil,
the
plastic
foil,
foil,
yeah,
foil top. So you take that whole like plasticky thing off the top of the wine, and then you take your shoe off, yeah, and you put the bottom of the bottle of the wine into
the heel,
like,
of
the
your
heel
shoe.
Of the shoe where your heel would go, and then you holding the bottle, and with the shoe you smack that thing, you know, on the sidewalk. They were doing it
against
a stone wall,
yeah,
in this video. And what it does, there's actually a physics explanation for this, in terms of the movement of liquids. That when you do this, you get all of this liquid moving in the same direction.
So the force of the liquid is what pushes.
And the force of the liquid pushes. Each time you smack it, it pushes the cork out a little bit until it reaches a point where, you know, you can just grab it with your hand and unscrew it.
And the whole notion is when you watch this video, and it's when you watch a video, it's the heel that cushions the
right.
whole exercise so the bottle doesn't break.
Does
but in
shake?
The example we
yeah.
saw, it, you hit it the first time, you slam it the first time, corkscrew comes, pardon me, the cork comes out a
yeah.
quarter of an inch,
yeah.
then a half an inch,
yeah.
and ultimately you just pull it out
voila.
With your hand.
Voila, he says.
Yeah,
and
it was
just,
pretty good.
And then,
when
yeah.
the real people
yeah.
did it, it took the more smashing, but they finally got
yeah, I think
them
it's
out
something.
Too.
I think it's something that practice makes perfect.
No, but Marjorie's never needed that because, you know, she always travels with a ceiling hook
I
in,
do.
Her, in her puck.
I have several
so
with me today because you never
and
know.
And with the rise of screw caps, I mean, this doesn't really come up
I love screw
so
caps.
Much. This doesn't really come up so much.
I love screw caps.
Yeah, but don't you want to go back to the cork now that you know that if you don't have a corkscrew, you always have a shoe?
I do want
to. I mean,
you know
I
what?
Am so dying to try this.
You know, like, what? There's a,
I wish I had brought an appropriate bottle. And we could have done it.
Next time. By the way, next time really you are going to bring it.
Yeah, oh, yeah, we will do that. Sure.
We only have 2 minutes left. For those of us who actually don't know much about wine but are aficionados of California wine, this whole climate change
yeah.
thing has potential to have really short-term but particularly long-term
yeah.
devastating effects. What's
yeah.
the skinny?
Yeah.
What are people saying?
Well, climate change overall and drought in California for the last couple of years. I mean, one thing that makes grapes different from other agricultural crops is that, like most crops, require a certain amount of water and then are drought resistant
mm-hmm.
on top of that.
Right.
Grapes are the opposite. They require almost no water and they're water resistant. So this drought in California, you know, the grapes are weathering it pretty well. I mean, after 2, 3, 4 years, they start to suffer. But what we're seeing from this drought actually is better, more concentrated, more intense, more flavorful, you know, better tasting wine, but less of it. If this drought goes on for another couple of years, California wine country could be in serious trouble.
Is that hyperbole? What I've
read
this morning is they literally were saying in a couple of years,
yeah.
assuming the droughts continue, we only have 45 seconds, there really could be no crop.
Well,
it's already been
2 or 3 years of drought in California. Grapes are very able to sustain themselves in drought for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. But we are going to reach a point where, I mean, grapes need some water. I mean, they don't, you know, they don't need no water. They need some water. And eventually, if this drought continues, it could be big trouble for California wine. Napa, Sonoma specifically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
Napa
very
and
scary.
Sonoma, yeah.
And half the places yeah. there could be, only half the places could be able
yeah,
to
or
sustain.
Or, you know, imagine if you have half the places making half as much wine. I mean,
so essentially what you need, can we sum up this conversation, Jonathan? I think what you're saying to us is to get good wine, you need two things: a limited amount of water and a shoe. Is that correct? Is that
I was going to say three.
What's the third thing?
Music and a shoe.
Music. Yeah,
I think if you have those three things, I think you're in
good place. Yeah, or a ceiling hook, as we discussed before. Just
by the way, were you a fan of the Honeymooners when you were a kid? Honeymooners
sure.
One of the funniest shows ever.
Oh, yeah.
And what I thought of when I thought of this music thing is that Norton and Jackie Gleason, Ralph, are going away to some raccoons convention, and they're going to take wine, and they're going to drink wine on the train, and Trixie and Alice, their wives, empty all the wine out and put grape juice in the bottles, and the whole show is about how they get drunk.
They get so drunk
on the grape juice because
the power of suggestion.
Exactly.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Jonathan,
as always.
Thank you, guys,
for coming in. Jonathan is the founder of the Boston Wine School and author of Wine Lover's Devotional, 365 Days of Advice and Lore for the Ardent Aficionado. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan,
for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Emily's List and Assistant Secretary of Health, Dr. Howard Coe. If you're doing production credits, which I am going to do, I want to include our new intern, whose name is Devin Karambelis. That's in addition to our regular production team, which is Chelsea Mers, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, and our engineer, John Parker. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. I am... Okay. All right.
Fine. We know
we're
who you are.
Laughing.
Who are you people?
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy, and I'm going to buy a bottle of wine and a shoe.
And I made it through another show. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.